Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. About 40,000 people protested in Moscow on Saturday following state Duma elections they say were rigged. The anti-Kremlin protesters were mostly middle-class Russians calling for new elections. And while President Medvedev has vowed to investigate the election results, the protests seem to indicate that Prime Minister Putin is losing his public. Just yesterday, billionaire oligarch and majority owner of the Nets basketball franchise, Mikhail Prokhorov, is throwing his hat into the presidential race set for March. So to explain who's protesting, what Prokhorov's candidacy has to do with it, and if we're going to see an Arab Spring-like revolution in the Moscow winter, is Nina Khrushcheva, who was just in Moscow following and attending some earlier protests. She's the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, and she's also a professor in the International Affairs Program at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Now, who is protesting and why now?
As you said, I mean, there's Russian middle class, Russian lower class people. The workers are protesting. Going to the streets because they feel not only that the parliamentary elections were rigged on December 4th, but very incensed by the way Prime Minister Putin in September announced that, by the way, I am going to become a president again for possibly another 12 years. And I think the public, he lost the public image precisely because it was this matter of disrespect, is that I'm going to tell you how it's going to be, and you're just going to follow because you are a bewildered herd. And I think that finally, after 11 years of Putin in power, first as president and then as prime minister, finally got to the Russians that they're being duped and that stability and security that he promised is just a sham.
So was this just the last straw, or does this show a sort of evolution of thinking in Russia right now?
I think it's both. I think it is an evolution of thinking. I mean, the protest has been going on since 2010, I would say kind of vaguely, and they were very, very small, and they were very much supported by sort of small groups, people who owned cars and the taxes were unbearable for them, or people who were protesting their forest piece of plots because the building construction in Moscow was just completely corrupt and overwhelming and whatnot. So it has been brewing for about 2 years now and finally became, that I put it in quotes, but a sort of a revolution that we saw earlier for a year all around the world.
The Times reported yesterday that a lot of the people at the protests were members of the middle class who, they say, are the people that have most benefited from some of Putin's policies that have sort of enabled them to acquire wealth and acquire goods. This was a fascinating idea to me because I don't think that there's sort of perhaps the sense is that Russia is a country with a large middle class. So can you talk about that and sort of how that happened?
And this is absolutely true. I mean, the people did benefit from Putin's first 8 years or so they thought. I mean, I was an opponent of his right from the beginning because that was basically a ploy to return Russia back to an authoritarian rule, which he did successfully and precisely by giving certain stability to the large parts of the Russian population. So they did benefit. But I think the problem with once you sign a social contract with your leadership, whether it's totalitarian leadership or democratic, it's just different contract. And since Russia is neither democracy nor really a totalitarian state, it was very silly on his part to believe that that contract that he would promise stability and then would continue on and that social contract will last forever. That was just a silly, very unmodern proposition. And so the middle class was protesting not against all the amenities that they got during Putin, but fact that they really, it became stagnant. It was stifling. It was, there were murders on the road by the police. So all these things that they valued then were turning against, because every political system really needs rejuvenation. And it has been going on for 12 years. And the prospect it's going to stay on for another 12 became unbearable to all sorts of Russians, middle class, upper class, lower class, and whatnot.
So this is not about people not being able to eat or being able to find food on the grocery stores.
No.
It's really a political protest. It seems so far to have been very peaceful. There doesn't seem to have been any violent suppression. You know, is that going to last?
It has been some. I mean, it has been some. I was actually, when I was in Moscow about 2 weeks ago, 10 days ago, I was at a protest on Shevchenko Embankment, which is a kind of a remote area, and yet the protest was large enough, about 1,000 people. The police, militia, used to be militia, and now it is the police, modern world, that we now use. They can get very brutal and very frightening. What I find absolutely stunning and remarkable, that people are no longer frightened. They actually want to go to prison, because that's how they think their voice can be heard more and more. So it's the sort of, we look at it as an archipelago. It's the archipelago of protest that is turning into sort of a larger mass and larger land. And, you know, in the regime, what was interesting is that the regime allowed, you mentioned the Saturday protest, they allowed 30,000 people, because usually they try to stay away from large protests, and now they allowed 30,000 people. You mentioned Mikhail Prokhorov, who is now running, and I would put it in quotes again, for president, which is, I believe, is a sort of a government ploy to make an impression that this is actually a more democratic process. And I think it's one of the ways for Putin to assure that he can either remain in power in some form, or that he's not going to be immediately discarded, and, you know, the fate of Muammar Gaddafi doesn't await him. So it's very complex political forces, but Russia is awakening, and the process is on the way.
Let's make a call out to some of our Russian listeners. Maybe you're listening in Russia, or you are Russian and are living in the area. Do you want to weigh in on the anti-Kremlin opposition? Do you want to defend Putin? Tell us what you think of Mikhail Prokhorov's presidential candidacy. Do you agree that he is a sort of puppet candidate? 212-433-WNYC is the phone number, 212-433-9692. Again, we'll take calls first from listeners in Russia or from Russia who want to comment on the situation there. A couple of threads I wanted to follow from your previous answer. And I should mention that we are talking about the protests in Russia. And my guest is Nina Khrushcheva. She's the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, and she's also a professor in the International Affairs Program at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. You were talking about people having an increasing sense of security, that they are not cowed by the idea of being sent to prison. What is giving that to people?
I think it's I think it's just that way of being completely duped. Putin promised one thing, and although they felt that Russians felt he was delivering it, he was not delivering it. That process stopped. As I said, people are killed in the streets. There is rampant corruption. One of the reasons he was so popular with the Russians for about the first 10 years was because he promised, and in his way showed that he was able to root out Boris Yeltsin's corruption. That was the 1990s corruption, that sort of the wild 90s that they called in Russia, the building democracy. And then it stopped, and they, you know, KGB took over. It's not KGB now, it's a different, but sort of security forces, strong forces that they're called Siloviki in Russia, the military. They took over the structures and the processes, and I think that's what Russians object to. They want a little bit more of a political process. And another thing that I sort of, it is a funny answer, but I think it is somewhat true, is that Putin promised a strong leadership. He was a strong hand ruler, something that Russians usually like. But then he had a facelift exactly around 2010, and sort of that Berlusconi-like vanity that works in Italy really did not work out in the cold of Russia.
So all of the stuff that we have heard about, his getting photographed riding horses,
exactly,
bare-chested, tracking tigers, driving
kissing
Formula
dolphins.
One race cars, all of these things, they didn't rehabilitate his image?
They did. I mean, it was originally was fine, but as all PR, I mean, we all know about PR, it's good in moderation. When you do something every week of that kind of populist vain type, ultimately, instead of being respected and appreciated, because originally Russians thought, oh, we have a James Bond of contemporary Russia, how cool that is. But now he just became a laughingstock every time when he kisses a dolphin. I mean, everybody just...
So he undermined himself.
He undermined himself. I think he himself lost control of his image, and his advisors were either afraid of him or were not smart enough to tell him that he should take that in moderation and should keep up with a strong head ruler. And once you lose an image, you really lose the country.
Tell us more about the candidacy of Prokhorov. You know, he's obviously a figure that's of some interest here. He owns the New Jersey Nets basketball team, soon to become the Brooklyn Nets basketball team, and yet he's running for president in Russia. He's also an oligarch who's managed to escape the fate of some of the other oligarchs and who've been sent to prison. Why do you say his candidacy is a sham?
Well, and he's 7 feet tall, which we know for Putin is never a good thing. I mean, he doesn't really like people who are taller than 5'6", as he is.
Only if you get the wrong camera angle.
Right, exactly. So, and you really cannot have a camera angle with Prokhorov. There is no way. Well, he escaped the fate. I mean, I wouldn't say that he escaped the fate because those who had the fate of those oligarchs were actually in real opposition. I mean, I think you may be referring to Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former Yukos chief, who has been in prison since 2003 and is going to be in prison for quite a while. He was a real political force. He was a real business force. And as far as Prokhorov is concerned, there are very many oligarchs like that in Russia that are basically pocket oligarchs. And even if you're 7 feet tall, you can still be in a pocket of barely 6 feet tall. I mean, no, 5.6. Putin. So in this sense, he's certainly, I wouldn't even put him in the category of opposing leaders or even independently thinking oligarchs.
Is there anybody who could run for president in that category?
I don't think so, but everybody should run for president. All the opposition leaders, Boris Nemtsov should be doing that, the former prime minister, Alexei Navalny, the blogger, everybody. I mean, that really lets have an election and let people choose. It doesn't. And, well, there is another candidate that is Alexei Kudrin, who was a former finance minister who was just ousted in September because President Medvedev didn't like his fiscal policies. So Prokhorov and Kudrin, it is my belief that they're likely to unite and likely to either support Putin or back up Putin or do something to salvage that candidacy, that politician and that image. Another option, which is a kind of frightening one, and I don't know how much it can work out today, is that if Putin fires, if President Medvedev steps down, he can fire. President Medvedev steps down, Putin becomes the acting president, and then disbands the elections altogether, floods the streets with police, and Russia becomes a totalitarian state.
What do you think the likelihood is of that happening?
I mean, I think Putin is thinking that way. I'm sure that that's probably the way he wants to go. I don't know if he can. I mean, you know, I'm thinking of Colonel Gaddafi, is that he had his dungeons and his torture chambers long before he had a facelift. You really, I mean, if Putin wanted gulags, he would have built them a long time ago, because now it would be very difficult. As I said, people do want to go to prison. They're actually proud of their protests. They are not afraid. So in everybody, if everybody in the country would become Andrei Sakharov, there is very difficult to be, to have a totalitarian country. People are not afraid. That's it. They're not afraid.
We're going to take a couple of phone calls for Nina Khrushcheva. 212-433-WNYC is the number, 212-433-9692. We're talking about the protests in Russia. Particularly interested in hearing from you if you are Russian or if you are in Russia or if you have been to Russia recently. What are your thoughts about what's going on there, and where do you see the future of Russia going? Let's go to Dana in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Hi, Dana. You're on WNYC.
Hi, I'm calling from my cell phone, so please forgive me if I do cut out. But I just wanted to make a comment. I am not Russian. I am Caucasian from Russia, actually, from the Kabardino-Balkar region. I'm sure, Professor, you're familiar with that area.
Absolutely.
My mother-in-law is here visiting from Russia, and we've been watching Russian news, and I was surprised to see that the anchors reporting were saying that the American Fox News and the American news stations have been doctoring Greek protest footage, making it look like that there's protesting going on in Moscow. But in fact, there is not protesting in Moscow. Everything is happy-go-lucky here.
Can you comment? Can you speak to that?
Well, I mean, this is actually a stunning and a very ridiculous way of confronting the protests. And I don't know exactly what channel you guys are watching at home, but even Channel One, in fact, which is very, very Kremlin or government controlled, did report on the protests on Saturday. The opposition leaders were actually asked questions. So there may be some channels that doctor the Greek protests and some channels are reporting. But I think what it does suggest or shows to me is that they really don't know what to think about this. I mean, I think Putin is in deep disarray about how to react to this. I think he's genuinely stunned that he's not as popular as he thought he was, and that sort of when it first manifested itself when he visited a martial arts match with an American fighter, and he was heckled by the public. So I think it just suggests that they have no idea how to handle the information coming out and the protest. And it really, what you're saying, I actually haven't seen those reports, but what reminds me is that when there was a crisis in the Soviet Union, any crisis, a leader would die or something bad happened, there would be a swan lake on all channels. So we would be watching Swan Lake.
So that would be the cue.
Yeah, that would be the cue. That you know something horrible happened, but we are not going to be informed.
What about social media? I mean, you know, we all heard about how that played a role in the Arab Spring protests.
And it's
also
absolutely. It's Russia. According to some estimation, has the most internet users social media. And so social media has been, for the last 2 years, really has been fanning the protest. And in fact, the protest after the elections on December 4th was first announced by social media. And there were blogs all over various networks, internet networks, saying, well, are we going to bitch about it on Facebook, or we actually produce warm bodies in the street? And that was stunning.
What's giving people this sort of comfort? Is it because they know that there are lots of people out there to the sort of, you know, to embrace the prospect, as you say, of going to prison?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, I mean, social media has been being the same catalyst, whether you're in Russia or you're in Egypt or you're in America. It doesn't really matter. I mean, that's beneficial service that it plays. We know that there's somebody else going to be there with me.
How does that affect the sort of, you know, you were just there. We were talking about television. How does that affect the, you know, I don't know if it's called the mainstream media in Russia, but, you know, what you see on the television channels, is that affected by Facebook by, you know,
not
Twitter?
Really. I mean, you see, because most channels are really Kremlin controlled. I mean, they're not owned by the Kremlin, but they are Kremlin controlled. So you would see Putin meeting. I mean, it was very, very, very Soviet. I mean, that's so remarkable about Putin is that he's a neo-Brezhnev rather than James Bond.
So still. You can watch a video on YouTube and you can watch something on television, say totally the other.
Absolutely. And that's why, but that's that disparity is growing and growing and growing. So it was, once again, I'm thinking about 91 when Russia had the largest protest at, I mean, Russia, Soviet Union had the largest protest of ever had before it quickly collapsed. And it was the same thing. I mean, you know, Swan Lake was during the military coup against Gorbachev. Swan Lake was going on all channels, but we had CNN. And so CNN was actually showing Yeltsin on the tank standing and masses in the street. And that's what made that what became a catalyst for those protests. And the same here, it's the disparity between the official information and the unofficial one.
Now, Putin blamed Secretary of State Clinton for fomenting the protests. What was that about?
He was deeply delusional. I mean, that man is deeply, deeply delusional. And I really think that, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and there is just no way around it. I always remember when I see instances of it, and especially in Russia, that very serious instances of it, including Putin's delusions, is that I remember how my mother always says that Khrushchev in 1956 is not the same as Khrushchev of 1962.
Now, President Bush famously said that he looked into Putin's eyes and got a sense of his soul. Where are we now in terms of U.S.-Russia relations? Where is the Obama administration going to take this? What's going to happen if the protests get more intense? Where is that going?
Well, they clearly, I mean, it's clearly very supportive of the protests, rightly so. I think Putin really doesn't do himself any favors by blaming the administration or Hillary Clinton. Once again, his bad advisors, he himself lost touch with reality, but his advisors should really be doing a better job. Whatever process will be, I think the Obama administration would always be would be in a good position to deal with Russia.
All right, and we're going to have to end it there. Thank you so much to my guest. She is Nina Khrushcheva. She's a professor in the International Affairs Program at the New School, senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. When we come back, we will continue to talk about the middle class with NYU professor Jorge Castaneda. Thanks so much.
Thank you.